Hello and welcome to the Pink Bike Podcast. Now, our homepage has been flooded in this past week with all the sea otter tech, and we thought by the time that this comes out on the Wednesday, you've probably just about had enough. So we thought we'd do something very different, and I'm sat down with Sarah Moore to talk about why you should care about cross-country. Now, I have to admit, Sarah, I love riding cross-country bikes. I love the sort of trail riding thing. I'm not someone that needs to ride the gnarliest, craziest shit all the time. I don't know anything about the race scene, though. I know there's Julian Absalon.
So I'm here to convince.
Yeah,
convince you.
There's an up-and-comer called Emily Batty.
Oh, gosh.
She's going to do really big things.
Oh, gosh, Emily
Julian Absalon's still winning everything.
This is your history lesson with Henry.
Is that about right? Are they still the big hitters?
Totally. Yeah. You're just in 2024.
But it feels like in recent years, the discussion is that cross-country has really maybe got cooler, got radder and badder. Is that something that just the people say on the outside, or is that what the real hardcore fans feel as well?
I think it has gotten cooler. I didn't feel cool when I was a cross country rider. Like, you would go out in your spandex and go and crush some intervals, and it was almost like gravel riding. I mean, gravel riding is kind of cool now too, but it just wasn't perceived as cool.
Why is that? Why wasn't it cool?
I think the courses have gotten a lot more technical. Like, it was over 10 years ago now that I was racing, and I feel like they were just starting to make the courses more technical. But now the courses are like, they look pretty gnarly when you watch them on the live stream, but when you're actually there in person, it's like, oh, I kind of want, like, definitely not 100 or 120 millimeter travel bike. But yeah, that's what they're racing these on, and they're in full spandex and doing, like, the course in Brazil, the one that we just had in Araxat, had huge jumps. Like, I think that the courses are just a lot more impressive. The racing is also really tight. Like, you're talking about Julian Absalon, like, he and Nino Schurter kind of dominated for a long time. And when you have that, you know, maybe very tight race, it's not as exciting. Tight race, but between just two riders.
Yes.
But now that the field is so deep, like in both the men's and the women's race on the weekend in Araxa, the top 15, like any of them could have won. And so I think just kind of that suspense of like not knowing who's going to win, could somebody come from further back and end up winning, just makes the racing so much more exciting than it kind of has been maybe 10 years ago, you know?
And so, if someone was to watch their first ever cross country, follow the first ever weekend from cross country racing from start to finish, there are a lot of letters, a lot of acronyms. It's all a bit, what is the format of a cross country World Cup weekend?
Right. Okay. Yeah. You're talking about, there's XCC and XCO, and then there's like U23.
There's so much.
And Elite. So yeah, when I put up the results articles, or I'd put up the result articles, you look at them and you're just like, it doesn't like look that nice. It's not like finals and qualifying or even like semifinals. You like kind of know what process that comes. So the weekend, a cross country World Cup weekend, usually the riders will get there kind of like the Monday, Tuesday, a week before, and they'll do their practice. And first they'll practice usually for what we call the short track. And the short track, I think the first year was 2018 that they introduced the short track.
So it was the Eliminator or something before, hey?
So Eliminator was like a totally different World Cup circuit that didn't really ever like kind of gain momentum. It was kind of a cool like side-by-side racing format. I think there was like waves and like it was like a very short sprint versus the short track seems to have kind of more similar, I guess, skills needed to win it that you need to win a cross-country race. So it's like a lot more comparable, and like the racers kind of can go back and forth, and somebody who does well on the short track does well in the cross country often. Anyways, what the short track is the top 40 ranked riders can take part in this race, which takes place, new for this year. It actually takes place on Saturday when it's just a cross country round. It always used to take place on the Friday night. And now it'll take place on Friday night when there's like
there's
a cross country and downhill.
Right.
But it's taking place like the day before the longer format race. So the short track is 20 minutes, and racers go in, they do their first lap, and they'll tell them like based on that time how many laps they're going to do. And usually it's like a 2 minute lap. So it's a very short, like 1 kilometer lap. And they do it. It kind of like is like a road crit race or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's a lot less technical usually. Maybe like one or two hills.
And if you win one of these short track races, does that count as a World Cup win?
It counts as a World Cup win.
Or is it like an asterisk World Cup
win? It's kind of an asterisk, I would say. Like, so now, I think starting maybe 2 years ago, they actually, it has its own World Cup standings. So you can be the short track World Cup winner, or you can be the cross country overall World Cup winner. But...
Oh, God.
Yeah, I know. It's making your head hurt, isn't it? Sorry.
No, but why do we... Mountain bikers, we can't help but have stupidly complicated rates. But, like, it's the same with downhill.
Well, but, like...
It's so complicated.
If you look at it, though, like, if you just go on, like, Friday night or Saturday, whenever the race is, and you watch the short track, it's 20 minutes of racing. The person who crosses the line first wins. It's
okay,
super
I can get
fast.
On board with that. Yeah, yeah.
It's super right. exciting. There's 40 people. Mm. And then... Somebody will win the overall of the short track. But, and there is a world championships now as well for short track.
And so if you win the short track, does that set the order for Sunday?
Yeah, exactly. So there's kind of like, I guess like two parts of the short track. You can kind of be going for the short track overall, I guess. Probably not a lot of people are like at the beginning of the season, I want to go for the short track overall.
Yes,
it's kind of, you know, it's kind of more for... the top 24 places. So if you finish top 24 in the short track, you get placed in the top 24 in the grid in the cross country race, which is really important because it is so hard to like pass and make your way through the field if you start further back.
And you know, when you look at a start list, an XCO race, and you say you've got like one of the big hitters that's down, at what point is it like they're too far behind in terms of their start position to make an impact? Is it 5th, 10th, 20th, 30th? Like what's realistic, you know? Is it like actually 10th they can still do it, or is it?
So if you finish even, so like the first World Cup of this year, Christopher Blevins had a bad short track, didn't actually finish in the top 24. And he went on to win the cross country race the next day. So he started, that would be somewhere from like the fourth row or further back, depending on where, because after the first 24, then it's based on your UCI ranking.
Mm.
So he would have had a good UCI ranking at least. So the first World Cup, he had to start from like behind those first 24 riders, and he was able to make his way through the traffic and end up winning the race. Could any rider do that? Like most people can't have that. Like, and Yolanda Neff as well. She didn't have a great short track and she was able to finish, I think, 6th in the second World Cup. So there are riders that can make their way through the field, but often the courses, there's like a start loop and then there's the regular loop. And the start loop generally is like a little bit less technical, maybe a little bit more room for passing. But the one in Araxa did not look like that. It looked quite like it got to quite a steep hill pretty quickly.
Mm.
And so, yeah, riders just like, there's so much traffic, you have to get off and run. And even like within the first 20 riders, sometimes on the past two weekends, the hills are so steep that some, you know, one person unclips and then it's like a domino effect.
Yeah.
And everybody's suddenly running up the hill in the longer form cross country race. And so, yeah, it's just like passing people. And I mean, I don't know if you want to get into the details of the last weekend's race, but Christopher Blevins,
sure.
So he won the first one, came second in the short track last weekend, and then he crashed in the like first minute and a half, 2 minutes of yesterday's race. And he had to start from like 20 seconds. Like he had to straighten his handlebars, put on his sunglasses. Like he was lying on the ground, got up, and he was able to pass 80 people. Which is remarkable.
Wild.
Because he would have been behind all the people walking up that hill. While the, you know, the front of the race, they're just like in their groove, like, okay, who are the heavy hitters? Here we are. Okay, off we go. Getting into all the technical sections with no traffic. And he's like at the back trying to pick off people. And I remember like Tom Pidcock, when he did his first World Cup, I was actually just comparing for the Things We Learned article. Tom Pidcock started 76th at Albstadt in 2021. And you know, it was like, there's no way he can pass that many people. and still finish on the podium or win. Because everybody knew he had the skills and the engine to win, but not have the, like, not have, like, the ranking, like, starting from 11th or starting, like, Christopher Blevins was, like, further back than last. To pass that many people is just, it's so hard. Like, I can't, like, begin to explain. Like, if you pass one person, you know, it's hard. But to pass all of these people on these technical courses that are super narrow, or, like, they're not, you can't pass everywhere, you know?
And, you know, you said the word there, the big hitters.
Mm-hmm.
If we go through the, both, like, you know, the men and elite field, who are the sort of de facto presumed winners of a, because Nino Scherr, he must be what, 65 now, 66? Is he ever going to retire?
He actually, so yesterday he was racing, and in the beginning of the race, they said it was his 14 years since he took his first World Cup win. Mm. And he ended up finishing, I think, sixth yesterday. So in 14 year span, he's, yeah, I mean, he's won 10 overalls. He's won,
wild.
Like, yeah, world championships.
So. I've just recorded a video about, well, a couple of weeks ago, about Fort William. Mm-hmm. It was like a little sort of, to set the scene there, and looking at some of the stats. And it was like, it was something ridiculous. Like in 2002, Greg Minnaar scored his second Fort William World Cup, got like within the top 10.
Yeah.
And then he went on a run of like 20 years or like 18 years, you know?
Yeah.
Of consecutive top 10s.
Yeah.
Which just, what, the longevity. It's crazy.
It's remarkable. Yeah. And
do you think Nino Scherter, because he's the reigning XCO champion?
XCO overall.
Yes. Yeah.
Go.
Nice.
Yeah.
Thank you. Got there in the end.
He didn't win the world championships this year for the first time in a while. Tom Pinnock won that. So it's kind of funny seeing Nino Scherter in the pack, not in the rainbow jersey.
I wonder what, there's also like in road cycling, it was like Peter Sagan only spent like, it's something ridiculous, like 20% of his entire career in his trade team jersey.
Right.
Because the rest of it was in national or world champs or leaders jerseys.
Yeah.
I wonder the same with Nino Scherter. He's probably spent, it's weird to think of him in the other, in the Scott trade team kit.
Yeah,
trade
well, the first World Cup, he actually didn't have a good race. But for the first like half a lap or lap, I was like, oh, there's Nino Scherter. Because it was somebody in the Scott team kit. But it was not actually Nino Scherter because his teammate was doing really well and he was off the back. But it's true, he wasn't in the world championship jersey that this year. But even his teammate, like, they look so similar.
Yes.
Like, they, you know, I wasn't sure who it was. But
so we've got Tom Pidcock, Nino Scherter. Who else? Who are the other big hitters?
So Tom Pidcock, he didn't do the first two rounds this year. But yeah, obviously he's a heavy hitter because he's won the world championships last year. He's the reigning Olympic champion. Pretty much any race he seems to enter, he seems to have a fair chance at. And same like Mathieu van der Poel as well, has won a bunch of World Cups, but not recently. He actually crashed out of the World Championships last year. Other heavy hitters, I mean, it does change each year, but kind of there's like the top 20 people coming into the year that like kind of shuffle around, I guess. So like coming into the year, we did like our form guide on, you know, who's probably going to do well based on last year's results. And then get to the first World Cup and it's American domination, it turns out. I think because, and American and French riders are like working for Olympic qualification right now. So depending on, like, because it's an Olympic year, those, every nation gets a maximum of two if you're ranked in the first eight countries, and you get one rider if you're ranked between, I think, 9th and 19th.
Mm-hmm.
So people are fighting for those positions. And right. So you kind of need to peak early in the season if you're, you know, from Switzerland, if you're from...
the real powerhouses.
Yeah, the real powerhouses still only get two people.
Wow.
And this is down from three people. So the last Olympics we saw, there was three riders from the top nations, and now there's only two.
Is that to make it sort of fair in how those places are distributed, or is it to make the field smaller overall?
I think it's to make the field smaller overall. From what I was reading, like, they were trying to just like get the numbers down at the Olympics.
Yeah, because the village just doesn't have enough
Yeah.
Space almost, I
yeah,
think.
Yeah, so people are like, oh, can you add this sport? Can you add this sport? Can you add this discipline? And also, I mean, the part that's great is they are trying to get equal numbers of women and men at the Olympics. So now they've achieved gender parity, but it means that, like, yeah, we're some there's just fewer people in each field overall. Yes, so totally. It makes it harder to qualify for some nations.
And what do you think the general, because I think the pink bike audience has a set of opinions about, like, you know, Mathieu van der Poel coming in, about the sort of reshuffling they were also, the UCI felt was ready to do to hopefully give him a fair crack at world champs. What do you think the more sort of, you know, hardcore cross-country fans feel about these big road stars coming in? And should they have the red carpet rolled out for them? Because, I mean, it's good for the sport, I guess. And it's not like they bought their way to the front. They've just got really high ranking in another very similar... I don't think it didn't seem that crazy. What do you think?
Yeah.
Is your opinion, and what do you think the readers on the room sort of thing?
I think for, like, last year ahead of World Championships, what happened was there was, like, a couple riders that were coming in from other disciplines that at the last minute... the UCI said, oh, if you have a high ranking, I don't remember what it was, like the top 10 or something, in road or another cycling discipline, we'll bump you yeah. up in the field.
Yeah.
And I think that overall people were unhappy about that because it was very last minute. And also even riders like Tom Pidcock had done the first World Cup in order to get points.
Right.
Because the points affect your grid position. So he wanted to have a good grid position because he knew he wanted to go and try to win world championships. And so he's like, well, I could have, you know, done a road race and, you know, made my trade team happier if I, you know, hadn't gone and done this last minute. And so I think riders were largely upset about that because it was last minute. It was just a change. But having road racers in the field, I think it definitely brings, I think, more eyes to mountain biking, which I think is good. I think the downside that we've seen where riders are kind of like Pidcock and Mathieu van der Poel are jumping in and out of it. Mm. And even Puck Peters this year we saw, she won the overall last year. And then this year, she didn't do the first two rounds because she was doing the Tour of Flanders. And so having not all the riders being in the field makes it seem like a lesser win sometimes,
yes.
Which I think that's where it's difficult. Because if you're like, oh, well, you know, Mona Mitchell-Voller wasn't there because she was sick. Pauline Ferrand-Prévot wasn't there this year. So these are like kind of some of the heavy hitters in the women's field, like we were talking about. You know, Pauline's the world champion, but because she's qualified for the Olympics, she's like, maybe I won't go to Brazil this year. I've won 6 races already this year, but the travel to Brazil, last time she got sick, she went to Brazil. So, you know, maybe just the travel, you know, when you're mostly used to racing in Europe is just a little bit harder. And so she decided these races weren't important for her. She's not focusing on the overall this year. She's focusing on one race, the Olympics. But the women's race, you're like, oh, well, those people weren't there. You know, what would have happened, you know? And maybe Hayley Batten still would have won yesterday's race. Jenny Risvid still could have won the first race, but it's always kind of that question. And same with, like, if Tom Pidcock and Mathieu van der Poel had been there for the men's race, like, would the results still have been the same? Yes. So I think that's kind of the hard part about having people in multiple disciplines is it's always hard to match race calendars so they can do all the races.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it feels like when a big road rider comes in and maybe at the sharp end, but they don't win or anything, it adds a lot of credibility to it.
Totally.
When they come in, win, and they go away and they come back and they win and they go, it makes it feel a bit like they're just picking this
that
up and putting
like
this down.
It's like child's play or something to win it. So it's nice when, you know, the dedicated cross-country riders are able to win when they do that. And sometimes, you know, it totally depends like on the race. And we've seen, you know, Pidcock or Mathieu van der Poel come into the race and not win. And we've also seen them come in after not racing mountain bikes for a while and win. So it's...
Yeah, I mean, I suppose you could also say, I've heard friends of mine in the sort of more cross-country side of the World Cup racing scene say that one thing that they are grateful for the road scene is that it... How to put this? It makes XE teams pay the athletes a bit better because otherwise they're just going to get pinched. Maybe not by a World Tour team, but maybe by a Pro Continental team, X, Y, and Z, because I don't know. Mm-hmm. And that seems pretty cool. How do you think these trade teams feel? Do you think, you know, Team Ineos are saying to Tom Pidcock, oh yeah, give it a go, please. Do you think, you know, Alpecin, De Koenig, is that where they are now?
Yeah, I think so.
Are saying to Matthew van der Poel, like, oh, go and do it. Are they like, come on now. We only really, the audience for a flat stage in the Tour de France is going to be 10 times, maybe probably more, than a World Cup win in XE. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you think the trade teams feel about it?
That's a good question. I know, like, for Tom Pidcock and Pauline Ferrand-Prevot, like, Pinarello just basically developed a mountain bike for them. Like, when Tom Pidcock won the Olympics, he was on a BMC kind of, like, blacked out bike that his trade team wasn't selling. So it seems like they are invested in making sure he has the tools.
But do you think, no disrespect to Pinarello at all, do you think, I imagine Tom Pidcock would have been quite happy to be like, no, you don't make me a bike. I'd rather have free reign on everything.
Totally.
And for the average, the sponsors that would be influenced by, I mean, I understand why Pinarello, they're spending X amount of money, huge, probably millions to sponsor a road tour team. They're like, well, we want it all. But at the same time, you know, is it not better to have Pinarello win on the top and actually ride a bike you win on, maybe?
I mean, I think they were winning on that. They both won world championships on that bike last year.
Okay, well, so shut up then.
I think it's, you know, it seems good enough. Like
their press releases are always so wild.
Yeah.
It gives me a bit of like, oh my God, like it's like a jarring effect. Like,
yeah. No, but they, I mean, who's to say whether it was the bike, but the bike is good enough for
the
them
bike is good enough,
to
yes.
win on it. And it says the name of their sponsor. But it does sound like Tom Pidcock's planning to do the Tour de France and then having a week to rest before doing the Olympics. So if the Olympics was really important to his trade team, they probably wouldn't be like, can you do this Tour de France thing that's like 21 days of really hard efforts before you go and try to win the Olympics?
And is he kind of graduating to a GC contender yet, do you think? Because he's had little runs, but he's also had that sort of, you know, Amstel Gold style races still, very much. And it's hard to sometimes reconcile how you could do both.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know enough. Like, so you talked to the Boombox people about the race tapes. I started watching and kind of whether mountain biking needs this drive to survive. Mm-hmm. And I started watching the Tour de France Unchained series on Netflix. And I also watched some of the Drive to Survive. I haven't watched it all. But two sports that, like, I know not very much about. And, like, honestly, watching those series makes me care and, like, also gives me enough information. Like, when you ask, do you think he's a GC contender? I'm like, well, what did the video say?
What did the pause between the highly dramatic music and, like, a shadow, a backlit presenter say? Yeah, no, it's fair.
Yeah.
It probably does do it good.
Yeah.
But no, I think...
I don't think he's a GC contender yet. I think he's more of a stage...
Yes, I think he has had little runs at the Vuelta and stuff.
Yeah.
But I think for a lot of these trade teams, I think it's probably...
He will be if he's not. I feel like he's got the engine to do everything, right?
Yeah, totally. But I think it's probably a very sort of unappetizing time to get into GC battles because you've got Jumbo and you've got, you know, Pogacar. And it feels like they kind of, between them, it's like, we could just win these other races instead of, and they can have the Tour de France sort out between them, you know?
Yeah. Well, but then there was a huge crash at one of the road races earlier this year where at least two of the, like, Tour de France, GC, you know, favorites going in, Vingegaard and I rode, like a bunch of them crashed.
Wout van Aert got done as well. Real bad. Yeah.
He's won Tour de France stages as well. Mm. And so all these guys crashed and, you know, broke multiple bones and lung punctures and all this stuff. And so, yeah, just making it to the Tour de France start is hard enough, even if you're not competing in two disciplines.
Yeah. as we look towards the women's field, and we talk about multidisciplinary. Pauline Ferrand-Prevot is probably one of the most decorated cross-discipline riders ever, if not the most. You mentioned that she's really structuring her season this year around that sort of Olympic glory. Why do these riders? And obviously this, you know, treat me like an idiot here. You know, monosyllabic answers fine as you really break it down for my brain that can't understand. Okay, if you're a 100 meter sprinter, I get why you care so much about the Olympics. But in mountain biking, it feels like the Olympics are such like an afterthought. Is it the money or do they actually care about the Olympic gold and the audience and showing off? Like, to me, a world champs win is cooler. When I look at a rider's fucking retinue of results, say, I'm not going, oh, the Olympic bronze. I'm like, world champ silver or whatever. You know, I think that's so...
No, I think definitely the Olympic. There's just something about it. Because it only comes around every 4 years, right? Mm-hmm. And so, I can't remember, like... The first Olympics was not...
It was 2000, I think, was it?
Like, yeah, 96. Like it wasn't that long. Like we haven't had mountain biking in the Olympics for really that long. And so the number of Olympic medalists is like so few, especially when you look at like Julia Absalon won 2 golds, Nino Schurter's won bronze, silver, and gold. Yeah. And so there's very few people that have been able to, you know, I think it's kind of like just checking that goal off of your, like, put it on, you know, your resume. Mm-hmm. It's like, Paulina has been world champion in multiple disciplines in multiple years in a row. And so she's kind of checked that off. And the next big thing for her to win is the Olympics. And mm-hmm. so I think that's why for her, just like wanting to try and put everything into that makes sense versus like another rider who, you know, hasn't won the overall before, hasn't won a World Cup before, hasn't, you know, just qualifying for the Olympics. And I think it's about representing your country.
Yes, right.
And I think it's, yeah, you get to do that at World Championships, but it's on so much of a smaller stage. Like usually the World Championships is just cycling. You might even only have cross country. Like it could be, you know, downhill could be at one venue, cross country could be at another venue. So it largely feels the same as another World Cup versus the Olympics. There's like the Olympic Village, there's all the different sports. There's, I think, mainstream media interest, which I think at the last Olympics was like pretty difficult for Pauline Ferrand-Prévot and Loana Lacombe because they didn't end up finishing on the podium. And it was like the French media was like so hard on them for not winning. Kind of like they were like, you know, pumping them up that they could win and they could have won, but it's like one day, you know, it's one day every 4 years. Where the mainstream media care about your sport, basically.
And they probably do so with a lot less the understanding about how bloody difficult it is.
Oh, they zero see, understanding. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, totally. Like it's, yeah. Like I think, you know, watching all the World Cups for 4 years, you understand that 4 years ago, the person who won is not necessarily the same person that won this year or last year, or like Yolanda Neff, you know, won the last Olympics, but her past couple of years have not been...
Why do you
great.
Think that is? Because Yolanda Neff seems like, I don't know, to me as someone like a layman, she seems like the most well-rounded rider mm-hmm. that has that kind of real kind of like touch of magic sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But then other people just win more. What's
she,
that?
She did win.
She had a really good couple of years.
Yeah.
You know, especially when she first went on to track and stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, that 2018 ran at Le Bresse, remember she kept puncturing?
Oh,
I mean, she's just, that's that era, Yolanda was like amazing, but it just feels like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Like it's, I mean, I think the field is so deep right now. She used to be, I think, she's still one of the best technical riders, but she used to have, I think, really a step above everybody else and be able to win because of her technical prowess. But now it's, I think a little like the other, like watching, you know, Jenny Rizvids and Haley Batten, like Haley Batten trains in Squamish throughout the winters on like slippery, like loamers that we have here with like a bunch of enduro riders. And then, you know, goes to the first World Cup. And Jenny Rizvids was apparently training in Finale Ligurie ahead of the race season. And so the technical skills of these riders are just like next level. And so, I mean, Yolanda Neff is still really good. She came fifth the first World Cup and sixth the second. And so, yeah, she could come and win another medal. You know, the top 10 is kind of anybody's race.
I think it's funny because I think mountain bike is still young enough of a sport where sometimes the people that, you know, I think another good example would be, you know, in the downhill side of thing, someone like Tani Seagrave, where they were responsible as one of the riders that pushed the field to become, to get to the next level by bringing a whole, you know, with Tiny, for instance, I think she's probably maybe the first elite female downhill World Cup racer that was like, not just trying to make the tech count. She was actually like smashing the jumps. She was really stylish, et cetera, et cetera. And then that like inspires or pushes the field kind of beyond where they end up being at a current, another moment. And I hope they crack on again in the future. But similarly enough, you know, Ilan the Neth, like such a technical athlete. And it pushed everyone to what they should expect to have to do. And then everyone else starts doing that. And then she loses her advantage in a way.
Totally.
It's kind of an interesting, you're kind of sowing your own seeds.
Yeah.
Another sort of big rider that, because for me, they're just, like I said, my interpretation of cross World Cup cross country racing is there's always like these big stars and then some like either Leona Lecomte comes out of nowhere and wins like she did. I think she came around like 2019, 2020 when she was on that Massey team.
I can't remember what year, but she won like the first three or four
and just came
openers. And same with Kate Courtney, I think 2019. She'd won the world championships in 2018 and then came and like won the first three or four World Cups. And like same with Loana the next year, I think she won the first three or four World Cups. So yeah, sometimes there's riders that come out of nowhere. And Rebecca McConnell won 2020, last time we were in Brazil, 2022, I think she won the first three or four World Cups as well. So yeah, sometimes this, some riders take a little bit longer to get into the race season. And sometimes people just start off and get their name known really quickly.
Because where's Kate Courtney at, do you think? She was like, she's like quite a big name and felt like she had a lot of early success in her career, you know, coming up probably what, second year elite, third year elite, and she was winning, winning big things. But she, at least on the results, maybe
not
quite.
Yeah, she really fell off the past couple years. Like, I don't know, like maybe over,
well,
like it seemed like she was still working really hard and obviously was trying to put all the pieces of the puzzle together. She had the, you know, support of the Scott SRAM team, which seems like obviously an amazing team because, you know, Nino Schurter is her teammate. It seems like they have great support. I know ahead of this year, she changed coaches. And sometimes that's just like, you need a little refresh like that, change coaches. And the first two World Cups this year, she's been top 10 or top 11. And so something, it seems to be working again.
Like so she said, tremendously it's, hard to get a top 10.
It's like a gradual rebuilding, I think. And, you know, maybe she could be on the podium again later this season, you know, and even being, you know, top 10 at a World Cup is very impressive, especially, like she was kind of like, just outside of that top 10. Like we weren't seeing her name for whatever reason. Like sometimes it could be, you know, recovering from like Hayley Batten won a couple or first, I think she came like first, second, third in her first elite World Cup races in 2021. And then she won this World Cup. And same with Simon Andreasen. Like it had been, he won the last World Cup, but it had been several years since he'd won last World Cup. So that's why sometimes it's kind of hard when you're like, who are the favorites? It's like, I would not have pegged Simon Andreasen or Christopher Blevins for these first two World Cup wins because it had been years since any of these athletes had won a World Cup. And same for Jenny Risvis. She won a World Cup. The last time she won it was in 2019. So, you know, sometimes they're on the podium or not, but it, there's just like, one, the field is so deep. And then two, I think like Hayley had a concussion, like, you know, these people can get injured or you can like overtrain or, just like team dynamics aren't working. Like in, you know, the Trek Factory Racing, they did that race tapes video it was like, oh, like team structure, even if you're on an established trade team, they can make big changes that really impact your racing. And so there's just so much that can change for an individual year to year, and it's so hard to be dominant like year after year. That's why it's even more impressive that Nino Schurter has been able to be this dominant through all these years. But yeah, now the Specialized Factory Racing team, like they've dominated these first two World Cup races, so it seems like something is working for that team right now.
An Olympic cycle, for instance, just a good unit of measurement, a lot happens in normally 4 years, in this instance three. You know, I just think of all the, that's what I find amazing about like riders that are really, really consistent in any sport, you know, and any athlete. It's just to have the presence to continuously chip away at something and not just, you know, go off the rails every 6 months. But for whatever reason, I think it's quite amazing. But there's this guy called Graham Potter, who's an English soccer coach.
Soccer. Yeah, you'd call it football, right?
Yeah, English football. And he's a really interesting guy. And he's got this basically he ended up taking a job as he was just establishing his coaching career in like the fourth tier of Swedish football. Like, so Sweden isn't a powerhouse in soccer, as you know, it's like probably like, you know, 10th or 12th nation in terms of the rankings in Europe. And he had this sort of theory that, like, you know, you might play football for 2 hours a day, but you're human for 24 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
And basically just found really, really good footballers who dropped off other people's development teams and youth teams. And he did weird things. Like, he got them to, like, the team, football team, to, like, perform musicals or read poetry. And basically, because he was like, they need to be confident enough to perform.
Mm,
yeah, and they need to be like confident and like appreciative and like, you know, yeah. And it was just so interesting. Like, they basically found all these amazingly talented players and didn't really work on the football in the same way, but more of like on getting them like some real steel and confidence. And I think, you know, in something like mountain biking, where it's just you just got to go out and do it, and it's so competitive, it must be enormously hard. And it makes it all the more impressive that someone like Nino Schurter has been doing it for a decade and a half.
Yeah. And that was, he said, he's like, I won my first World Cup 14 years ago. And they're like, what do you remember from that day? And he was like the pain cave. Like, that's, they go deep in the pain cave and like suffer for, you know, an hour and a half. And I think maybe that's another thing I didn't mention earlier, is like the races used to also be longer. Mm. And so that's, I think, another reason that maybe it's a little bit more exciting now, is like the races are usually an hour 15 for the longer race, which is still like a pretty explosive short race in the grand scheme of things. Like, yes, you're not watching for, you know, 2 or 2.5 or 3 hours.
And why the change of length? Is that for spectators? Is that for broadcasters? Is that for what the riders want?
I think it was probably for spectators and for broadcasting, because the events, are all broadcast. And I think, the broadcast makes it a lot more exciting that you can follow a whole course, as opposed to if it was a longer course, you wouldn't be able to follow.
Because it used to almost be like an out and back, hey?
Like cross-country races started, they were, you know, they do the same bike for the cross-country and the downhill, and they'd, you know, go down a big wide trail for the downhill, and they'd go on a big huge loop in the middle of nowhere for the cross-country. And now it's like the races, the laps were actually less than 10 minutes at this last venue.
Well, for a spectator on the side of the course, that's amazing, right?
Oh, it's awesome. You get to see the riders every 10 minutes, and, you know, they change the lead and who's going first. And I think it's harder if you're trying to establish yourself in the field, because they're going to cut a lot more riders, so you can't get lapped. And if you're within 80% of that first rider, I think the rule is, or at least it was when I was riding, you're going to get pulled off the track.
Oh, you get pulled off?
Yeah, because, I mean, if you don't want the fastest person to then get stuck in traffic because they're catching the last guys.
I'm in Formula One world. I thought they got a blue flag and they've been told to get out of the way, but they're just
off. They're pulled off the course entirely.
Jesus.
That happened to me. I remember when I was like started racing, and you know, I'd show up as my first year elite, and we've got like, I don't know, Catherine Pendle or Emily Batty would be doing the Canada Cup, and I'd be like, oh, I guess I'm not gonna finish today's race.
I never thought about that. You don't even get to finish.
Yeah, and sometimes like if the person is like really close, like occasionally you'll see them like catch the back marker on the live broadcast, but usually they pull them in time, and so you don't see that. But yeah, like you'll look at the results sometimes, and there'll be people that have like -3 laps, -2 laps, -1 laps, and because at that point they were 80% of the fastest rider's time, and so that fastest rider group doesn't catch the last rider, they get pulled off at the start finish area. Sure. So you'll get waved out.
That'd be so disheartening.
Oh, totally.
You travel to Brazil.
Yeah.
And you don't even get to finish on your own terms.
Totally. Yeah. No, I'm always surprised when I see people who, you know, have gone to multiple World Cups and finish negative laps every time. And you're like, oh, at what point, you know, it's hard because when you start further back, you have to pass more people in order to it's slower for the start. And so you're like, well, maybe I was as fast on that lap as somebody who was able to finish the race, but because I was started so far back, I wasn't able to make my way through the traffic.
Yeah.
I got, you know, I was walking up all those hills, and then you still get cut. So yeah, it's definitely like a brutal part of the race.
Because when do you think, you know, in terms of building and developing as a cross country racer, what is the, is it still like 26 or 28 where you kind of hit your peak? Or is it a bit older? Or is it because there's a lot of young riders now out there doing it, but it feels like it feels maybe not, I mean, the men's field is such a strange place because Nina Schurter just has disrupted what we kind of could glean from it. But it feels, at least in the women's field, like a lot of people bursting on and then kind of maybe, you know.
Yeah, I don't know if there's like a specific age.
I'm 32. Have I still got time?
Yeah, I think you do, actually. Yeah, definitely 32. You got a solid, like, you know, I think Nino Schurter's like 38, maybe?
Okay,
no,
should
I
call him out on Instagram straight away that I'm coming for him?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll do that right
definitely.
Now. Hey, Nino. So, my friend Sarah
said that, you know, I'm not too old yet.
Yeah, but I am too bad of a bike handler. But that's not nothing to do with you.
Yeah, 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 no, there's... Yeah, sometimes people like move up from the under 23 category. Mm. And that's another thing that is actually a cool part of Warner Brothers kind of taking over the broadcasting is that you can watch the under 23 races, the cross country races on YouTube for free, even if you have to pay for the elite races. There's the short track and cross country that you can watch paid version. And then there's the long distance under 23 race that you can watch on YouTube. And so it's brought a little bit more light to those riders and made it more exciting to follow them.
Am I right in thinking you can graduate to elite early, but then you can't go back down? Is that still the rule?
Ooh, I don't know.
I remember
about
at one
that.
Point it was.
I know you can graduate early. I wonder, maybe you're right that you can't go back. After that, I'm not sure about that. I know often the world championships is different. So like you can be racing World Cup level elite. And then for world championships, they'll kind of bring you back down. I know Mona Mittervaller was able to race in the elite category, though. And so they have made an exception for that. But usually it's like you'll see people who have raced up, then go back for world championships into the U23 category. But yeah, there's like a lot of young riders in the field that do well and then kind of pop onto the scene. And then, yeah, like there's some older riders like Pauline Prevot is now kind of like one of the, I think she's like 30 or 31. And it's kind of like you get a lot more tactical, I think. And you can see like the races are very tactical. And I know like Haley Batten said in the post-race interview, she's like, I think I went a little early, but like luckily it worked out. But you could tell like Jenny Rissman had like planned her attack perfectly because she's kind of been doing it for another like 5 or 6 years. I think she's kind of in her 30, 31 area as well. Like she and Pauline are kind of the same age. And so age I think helps with tactics. And I think the races are getting a lot closer and a lot more tactical on some of these courses. And so I think the having raced a lot more can help with that. But then you see Puck Peterse, who's just like raced a whole lot of cyclocross and road and mountain biking and comes on and she's got the engine, she's got the tactics and she wins the overall in her first year. So
she's wild.
There's, I don't know, age. I wouldn't say there's like a specific age that cross, like it's, yeah, quite explosive, but then people seem to be able to do it until they're a little bit later. Yeah.
In road cycling, there's a minimum weight of bike. Would it be cool that, imagine, I don't know, do you think that it would benefit in terms of the course, in terms of maybe even the racing, if there was a minimum weight of XC bike that was actually a little bit higher, because then people would run like more aggressive setups maybe because they wouldn't have to, you know what I mean?
Oh, I don't know, because I think part of it is that...
If, like, that is, when if we it saw, is the tech that makes it interesting, you know?
Kind of, because what Olympics was it that Peter Sagan... went to. It wasn't the last one. So
Rio.
Rio.
He had that fancy helmet that changed color and shit.
Yeah. And so he was able to qualify, but hadn't done a lot of mountain bike racing and he got a flat tire. And you know what? Like dialing in your equipment and knowing I'm going to sacrifice a little bit of weight so that I can have, you know, a burlier tire or not, or knowing like I'm going to put a dropper post on for this course, but not for this course. I'm going to run, you know, something heavier on, you know, one day and not another day. I think it makes it interesting. And like, obviously people still get flat tires and like still really good riders get flat tires. Like, you know, Schurter and Yolanda Neff have got a fair share of flat tires, but it's also sometimes you'll see riders taking the B line because they know that like the A line might be faster, but it's riskier because you could get a flat tire on there. So it's knowing like line choice, because basically it's like there are two tech zones usually on the course, but to get to the tech zone and still win the race is like, it barely ever happens, you know, like it's pretty hard to be close enough. And so you just really want to make sure that your equipment stays in one piece. And I think it's kind of an exciting part when you're like, it sucked. Like Jen Jackson, Canadian, she was in the top five. And I was like, oh my God, could this be her first podium? Mm. And then she gets a flat tire and you're like, oh, that really sucks. But it's kind of part of the racing, you know?
It is part of it. It's funny with mountain bike racing, how much effort goes into it.
Yeah.
And it goes to, we travel all over the world to do it. And fundamentally when races are ruined, it's almost always because the tires go flat.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Which is kind of like, yeah, it's just so hard to keep air in tires.
Victor Gretzky actually dropped his chain in the final climb of the final lap. And so he ended up coming second, but it was like, he probably would have won. It's like pretty hard to know, obviously.
Mm. And Nino dropped his chain in Worlds last, maybe not World. He dropped his chain at a race, I think.
Oh, I can't remember.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I knew that because I watched the race tapes.
Nice.
Sound like an expert. I think so.
Like, how did you know about this? Yeah, yeah, if that's possible.
Man, we should have Levy here because he'd be just, he like to finally let him grandstand about Nino Scherter.
Yeah.
Uninterrupted.
Yeah. Although I don't know if he actually watched that much racing. He just was like, did Nino win?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Nino's the only cross-country rider that matters. But like the field is, yeah, both men and women is like quite deep now. So I think that's what makes it exciting as well. Yeah.
Amazing. Well, I feel like I'm an expert on cross-country racing now.
I could go on for another hour here.
I'm going to go and be so toxic in the comments at the first available opportunity. Well, actually, if you follow the sport like I do, then just say that.
Well, do you care about cross-country racing yet?
Yes. I'm more invested now, actually. Now I understand like what the bloody acronyms mean.
Right.
Because I didn't know like the short course thing.
Yeah.
It's so, seems so stupid to me. It seems so anticlimactic.
Right.
Because on Friday.
But have you ever watched one? They're pretty fun to watch.
Well, no, because on Friday I just start getting results of things that I don't know what it means. And I'm like, so by the time Sunday rolls around, I feel like I'm already off the back of.
Right.
I'm like, why get invested now? Because there was something called short track, which I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
And is it important? I don't know.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, it's like the points do go towards the overall. I didn't mention that part.
Oh,
but
for God's sake.
But they count for less. So it's like 80 points for a win in short track go towards the
cross
country. Just
make it
overall.
Simple.
Yeah.
That's, you know, people don't want that.
But nobody really cares about the overall. It's more about like watching each race is exciting in itself, right? Like the battles that go on.
I'm a sucker for the overall. Like in downhill, I'm like, running the numbers, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess. Man. Yeah, just make it simple. Obviously, it's a really successful sport. They don't care about me. Fair enough. But at the same time, like, please, if you are listening, Warner Brothers, just make it simple for me, you know? And you get one more view. You might lose thousands, but I will watch.
Yeah, yeah. But you can follow downhill racing, which I think is almost harder to watch because you don't know who's actually winning versus this. It's like 6, 7, 8 laps. And it's like the guy who crosses or the woman who crosses the finish line, it's like they're winning.
Well, I think with downhill, I don't know, man. I think downhill is such a hard sport.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, in mountain biking, there is a genuine sort of, when it's just numbers and watts per kilos, it's very easy to look at the data. Not very easy, but it's easy, I think, to really provide like excellent punditry. Downhill mountain biking happens so fast.
Mm-hmm.
And Rob Warner's obviously amazing at it. But even through the years where Rob was commentating, when actually, I think maybe it's people disagree, but I always thought the person, his co-commentator, always had actually a really hard time to provide the technical analysis because it's such a fluid thing. And people, there's so many different ways to corner on a mountain bike, let alone pump and push, blah, 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 blah. And apart from stating the obvious, which would, you know, Rob's job would be there, like, they just did this. And then the person had to sort of provide some insight. And it's really, really, really hard. So I think downhill mountain biking is just a difficult thing to cover, full stop.
Yeah.
Let alone with A's and B's practice and semi-qualifying finals.
Yeah,
and
so
Jesus
I think like
wet.
Road cycling is, probably the easiest cover.
Yeah,
and understand.
The tactics are so obvious, right?
Yeah. And
there's
then
10 of them and they're riding up the hill trying to drop that poor guy there who comes from a small team.
Yeah.
And he's going up against Jumbo today. Good for him.
And then downhill is probably the hardest to cover. And then cross country kind of is somewhere in that middle ground where probably more people can understand it.
Mm.
But yeah.
But the downhill viewing figures are so much lower than cross country.
Mm-hmm.
That's the cool irony of downhill,
mm-hmm.
is that obviously we care, we love it. But
I was thinking about like how everybody calls, like when you're in a bike company and they call the downhill bikes are the F1 of
nonsense.
And I was like, actually, I'm pretty sure they're road cycling. They both have the Netflix series. Like,
yeah, right. Yeah.
They didn't go to the downhill World Cups first. They were like, we're going to go and, you know, talk to all these big trade teams and they know exactly how many grams of caffeine they need and how many bottles and exactly where they're taking their gels. Yeah. And, you know, they've got the machine is the athlete dialed. And then, I mean, some of those time trial bikes look pretty futuristic as well, even though like a lot of development goes into all these downhill bikes. Obviously you're kind of like, oh, I think actually I've been thinking about this recently. I'm like, I think road cycling is the F1 of cycling.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But I think what's interesting is,
and the wages too, obviously.
Yes. And the wages.
Millions of dollars. Like,
but I think what's interesting about road cycling, and maybe it's, well, I think, you know, if we looked at, if someone came in from another sport, they would say, make the fastest bike or setup as possible. And then the most adaptable rider who can ride the fastest bike or setup will do very well. And it's been really, I think it's really interesting to see, because in road cycling, they have so much data.
Mm-hmm.
They can just be like, this is faster.
Yeah.
So you just got to,
mm-hmm.
like, you will lose this, say your position, you lose this many watts, but you'll gain this in the aerodynamic coefficient. Just do it.
Yeah.
And then in mountain biking, like, there's so much, what is the complete lack of data?
Yeah.
And everyone is unlucky. That single member downhill is everyone from 5th to 55th is the top 10 rider, but they've just been unlucky. And I understand why this is, because they have the belief of having to, wanting to turn up and keep chipping away. But, and then everyone from 60th to 120th can qualify, but they were just unlucky.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? And it's like this thing where it's like, because there's just a complete lack of data, which is completely fair because it's a sport that's just so much less money in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard for people to then.
It's almost like you don't want downhill racing to get too much like road racing. It's like everybody takes exactly the same line and,
yeah,
you know, maybe. Like you kind of don't want too much data almost, because it is what makes it exciting is like, whoa, she took a line that nobody else took. Like,
wow. I don't think you want too much data, but I do think that the helping, you know, that sort of like money ball thing in downhill would help the talent rise to the top quicker,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and would help people who maybe are fantastic, because you get a lot of people that are amazing bike riders, but maybe not great bike racers,
mm-hmm.
and help them understand that and how they can, they want to make a career of downhill racing, what they need to do, or if they move away. Because there's so many people that, not so many people, that you speak to a lot of riders, obviously amazing riders who are so driven X, Y, Z, and they'll tell you, oh, at 2015, I was the fastest in split number 2 of qualifying at Fort William.
Right.
Because obviously that was an amazing thing, but like, okay, well, that was 9 years ago. You've been on the bubble for a decade now.
Right. Yeah.
But they haven't got the data to be there like, oh, actually, because, you know, if you do look at something like a sport like football, they have like, or baseball's a really good example, this concept called Moneyball, where it's like, these are the key analytical points.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same in cycling. Like, how much do you weigh? How many watts can you put out? Sweet. Watts per kilo. That's what's going to win. Off you go. In mountain biking, it's so much, sorry, in downhill, it's so much more like, what do you feel? Do you think you've still got it in you?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think you can do this? Can you, it's such a, maybe that's one of the romantic parts of it as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Even, yeah. I mean, cross country and road cycling, they're like, you need exactly how many grams of carbohydrates per, you know, hour of cycling or 20 minutes of cycling. And yeah, the carbohydrate revolution, just like how many carbs they're actually eating, but they know exactly how many they need in order to be fueled, versus, you know, I was interviewing Ronan Dunn and he's like, yeah, I have a couple of Red Bulls, sometimes a couple too many, and then I crash. And I was like, oh yeah, I wonder if that's like the exact dose of caffeine isn't actually known yet. And it's like, once he dials that in, that'll kind of be more of like less checkers or wreckers and more like just dialed racing.
But it's, yeah. So, but then mountain biking is such an individual sport, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they need these passionate, I mean, I sound like I'm bagging on it. It's more observations than anything. And most of all, it's because data will probably help riders understand how they can best maximize what they have to offer.
Yeah.
But like, it is those characters with a really strong individual spirit that make downhill mountain biking so special.
Totally.
So maybe we don't want to fucking overwhelm them with data.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. There's definitely like differences in all the disciplines, but they each are exciting in their own way, for sure.
Yeah. Well, I certainly feel more clued up on cross country.
That's good. You'll watch all the next World Cups?
I'm going to watch every single one. I'm actually going to Fort William. They don't have a cross country this year. But it feels like my World Cup season is kicking off on Friday.
Oh, wow.
Going to Fort William, going to go see the family, see the sights of England, all of them in 2 days, and then drive to Fort William. And honestly, he's going to get eaten by midges. The midges are waiting for me. They're like, there's this like kind of, basically I go there, and, but yeah, anyway, I just get to strawberry midges. It's like the feeding frenzy. So it's very, very exciting. But thank you very much for coming on.
Yeah, for sure.
And here's to not going to see us again next year. Hey, what a week we've had. Lovely. I'll catch you later.